Listen, there's a great work to be done. As soon as you win this court battle, you must deliver this message. Take advantage of this opportunity and declare a powerful message to this world. He expects more of us. He believes we can do more. Who's going to stop Christ? Who's going to stop Christ from getting this work done?
This is Behind the Work.
Welcome to Behind the Work. I'm Grant Turgeon. Did you know that the late Herbert W. Armstrong was an advocate for daydreaming? I will clarify this statement today and also talk a lot about Mr. Armstrong's experience with romance on the show. We're broadcasting to you live from the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus here in Edmond, Oklahoma, because this college bears the name of Mr. Armstrong. It should be obvious to you listeners that this man and the work God did through him is quite important to the mission of the Philadelphia Church of God today. God worked many miracles for Mr. Armstrong and for the work under him over the course of more than 50 years. And the church today just tries to build on what Mr. Armstrong started. For example, Mr. Armstrong was probably the inventor of true education as we know it in this modern age. When he was just 23 years old, he hadn't had any experience in a worldly college. And yet, when he was just 23 years old, he had already experienced full immersion in books and jobs that fit his goal of being successful in advertising. Remember, his uncle Frank gave him a lot of advice about pursuing the right career, a career that fit his aptitudes, a career that would really help him to grow. Mr. Armstrong took that advice. He looked to his uncle for help. He respected his elders, and he learned a lot because of that. And he put in a lot of work on his own time outside of a university curriculum to become self-educated. True education, that's something that only God's church knows about today. Mr. Armstrong says here in chapter 8 of his autobiography, which is titled Becoming a Publisher's Representative, "As president of a liberal arts college with three campuses on two continents today, I can say that this intensive education from the University of Hard Knocks and practical experience in application has made possible a college offering today's students a sound and practical education, acquiring the true values and supplying the missing dimension in education." There really is no other educational curriculum like this one, like the one at Armstrong College today, at its sister institution, Imperial Academy, our K-12 school, that really does have God and the Bible and His truth and His way of life as the foundation. And you can see that influence in every class, every activity, every job that our students go through. They really are learning life skills and becoming useful in every aspect of life. They are ready for real life when they graduate. Only what God did through Mr. Armstrong and what we continue today in the PCG can be considered the full extent of true education. Where did Mr. Armstrong get this from? It had to be God. It's totally unique. Look anywhere else in the world. You won't find anything like this. Mr. Armstrong had the rare quality of vision. He talked about turning his job on one sectional journal into an entire business as a publisher's representative for 9 bank magazines. He said here, "Most men are never able to see any possibilities of expanding their present jobs. They do merely what they are told, what someone higher up thought out and laid before them. Doesn't that sound a lot like colleges in the world as well? Just going through the classes, going through the motions, doing whatever someone in charge said without really learning how to think. Mr. Armstrong continues, or they use deceit to jerk the rug out from under the man above them. The Bible says that if we do only what we are commanded, what is expected of us, we are unprofitable servants to be cast into outer darkness. Most people go to one extreme or the other. While the big majority never think beyond their present jobs, never think out ways to do the job better, or to develop or expand their own job into something bigger, or to be preparing themselves for the better jobs ahead and promotions to them, a minority go to the opposite extreme. They are always trying to do that job ahead, or the boss's job, without adequate ability, preparation, or experience, and only throw monkey wrenches into the gears, causing damage, lacking wisdom, and judgment. Most men never seem to realize how the application of some of these principles makes all the difference between employee and employer, between mediocrity or failure and success. So that is really indicative of a couple of qualities that you need to have. You need to be trying, striving to expand and grow and develop in a career or whatever it might be. But at the same time, it does take education and preparation. Like Mr. Armstrong says here, one without the other pretty much leads to being worthless. If you have the education, but you just want to stay content where you are, never improving, never giving your company ideas for how to improve, never looking to take on more responsibility, well, that's not very useful. But if you have that kind of a drive and passion to excel, yet have no idea how to do it, you can end up getting in the way and only causing more problems than you actually end up solving. So it does take education combined with drive. And like a lot of you know, those are two out of the seven laws of success. That booklet, The Seven Laws of Success, written by Mr. Armstrong, is available for free at thetrumpet.com, as is the autobiography of Herbert W. Armstrong, which we are going through today. A lot of resources there at thetrumpet.com literature tab. So why did I say that Mr. Armstrong is an advocate of daydreaming? Well, he did say that there is a kind of daydreaming that utilizes imagination, that thinks up ideas, and as he says, mentally puts them to every test to see whether they will work. You can see how that would be constructive, right? Daydreaming that leads to ideas, that leads to projects and productivity, that leads to things actually getting accomplished. Mr. Armstrong writes here, to climb the ladder of ultimate success in accomplishment, one must exercise vision and, supplementary to it, imagination, the kind of active, practical thinking that produces sound and workable ideas. This doesn't just apply to work. This can apply to any part of life. This can apply to health and exercise. It can apply to reading and writing on your own time. It can apply to really pretty much anything. It can apply to family life. Thinking up ideas and then putting them to practice. Moving to put them into action. And as we will see, Mr. Armstrong's vision and imagination also helped him out in a big way in his romantic life. Now, that might be confusing to you at first hearing, but I will explain. Chapter 9 of the autobiography is titled, How I Met My Wife. He says here, no phase of any man's life is more important or has greater bearing on his future success or failure than the romantic experiences and their culmination in marriage. The same is true, conversely, in the lives of girls who have reached the dating age. As Mr. Armstrong recommended, the marriage age, ideally, if possible, for men is 24 to 26, for women is 23 to 25, and yet dating needs to be done for many years before that to actually find out if the person you're going to marry is actually the right one. You actually need to know the other person pretty well from quite a lot of experiences together, a lot of conversation, dating even in groups as young people is often encouraged by God's ministry. But especially when you become 18 and you graduate high school, you leave home, it's a great time for dating. Mr. Armstrong said, few young people today realize the seriousness of this phase of life. Proper dating has become virtually a lost art in America. Now, keep in mind, Mr. Armstrong wrote this almost half a century ago. So, what would he think about dating today? If he were alive today, what would Mr. Armstrong think about dating? The way the world does it. Today, we are in a hookup culture. People basically only get together if they are physically attracted to each other. There are all kinds of technological devices that allow people to get into sins in this area that were not even possible merely a decade or two ago. And it really only makes people more and more shallow, more and more irresponsible, and more unhappy. It really does cheapen sex, and it cheapens conversation. It cheapens dating. And it pretty much does away with the God-ordained institution of marriage. And it really is sad. And this is a reason that abortion is an epidemic. And you look at all these different issues, sexually transmitted diseases, even bullying because of private photos being released by hackers. All of these things are a result of not waiting until marriage. So Mr. Armstrong, even when he was in the world, even before God called him, actually did quite a lot to protect himself from common pitfalls of dating. He had a dating system. And this is absolutely fantastic to read about. He said here, therefore, my system was this. I would generally avoid even dating a girl unless she appeared, so far as I could then see, to be at least eligible if I lost my head and fell for her. See, he was really worried about falling in love with the wrong person and being trapped for life in a fruitless marriage. So he said, even if I did lose my head and fall for a girl, I better make sure she's of a certain quality before I even go on a date with her. Then he says, next, on my first date, one thing was always uppermost in my mind, to coldly analyze that girl from the point of view of what kind of a wife and mother she would make if I lost my head over her. If she definitely didn't measure up, I firmly avoided any second date with her. If I were not quite sure one way or the other, I would allow myself a second date if she appeared sufficiently interesting. If a girl passed my analytical test, then immediately I put all thought of marriage out of mind, but she remained on the list of girls who were eligible for dates if I desired them. So maybe people would think that that was maybe a bit too high of a standard from Mr. Armstrong. Yet look at the pitfalls that he avoided. He really did stay out of a lot of the negative trends of his time. Like I said, the trends are way worse today. But he didn't get into any abusive or wrong types of relationships when he was a teenager or a young adult. And he did wait until marriage. And the fruits of his marriage show that he did it the right way. Mr. Armstrong said, as a result of this system, I did date girls I felt were well above the average. I enjoyed a scintillating conversation. If a girl was unable to carry on her part of such an intellectual conversation or was lacking in any mental depth and brilliancy, she didn't interest me enough for another date. Like I said, he did have a really high standard here. It can be a bit different in God's church where we all have the same general and even specific goals a lot of the time. And of course, because we're all going in the same direction, because we are of like mind, we do date widely and we do date everyone of the same race in the church. And of course, of the same general age brackets too. But I would really have to say this is pretty much almost a perfect system for worldly dating. I hear a lot of stories about, you know, Democrats marrying Republicans or Catholics marrying Jews. And it just seems like when you have such a fundamental difference between you and your spouse, it can be really difficult to really achieve much of value together. When you have such severe disagreements in some of the most important arenas of life, that's a disadvantage. Mr. Armstrong was measuring these women, seeing that they were of the same mental capacity, seeing that she wanted to be a wife and mother and had the capability of doing that. Obviously, back then, people understood traditional, God-centered family roles. And he applied that in his analysis here. And really, as men, as leaders, when dating, this is probably a pretty good idea to look at women and see those types of qualifications to make sure that the ones we're dating or the ones we're pursuing certainly do want and embrace that role and are preparing themselves for it. Mr. Armstrong said here about one of the negative trends of his day. Back then it was called necking. Today it's called making out. He said necking belongs in marriage as a definite part of the marriage relationship. Humans usually reverse what is right. Think about this example that he gives. This really is astounding when you think about it. They indulge in this preliminary act of sexual arousal prior to marriage as a part of dating and then dispense with it after marriage, thus often ruining and breaking up marriages. In other words, they kiss when it's fun and exciting and maybe forbidden. And yet, when it should be done in marriage, it's not quite so exciting. And then the husband and wife become cold toward each other, and it can end marriages much of the time. How often we do it backwards to what God desires. And it really is a shame. Mr. Armstrong said here, I had certain ideals and convictions. And one of them was that a young man ought not to think of marriage until he was prepared to assume the responsibilities of marriage, especially that of supporting a wife. The idea of my wife having to get a job to help earn the living would have crushed my spirit, would have been the supreme disgrace. Now, of course, in a lot of situations, it might be necessary for the wife to work outside the home. But look at him here. Even before God called him, he understood the man's role, the man who needs to be the provider, the protector and the guide of the family. And he wanted to make sure he was ready in those areas before he got married. He didn't just blindly plunge into it without that vital preparation. Again, the fruits of his marriage prove that he did it the right way. Mr. Armstrong talks a lot about his, at this time, future wife, Loma. And just as I read this description of her, it comes up repeatedly through the next two chapters. Just think about what he is describing. And also think about what he is not describing. Mr. Armstrong says, "I hadn't seen such a fresh, joyous zip and go in a long time. She literally exuded energy, sparkle, good cheer, the friendly warmth of a sincere, outgoing personality. There was something different about her, something wholesome that I liked. She seemed to be a girl of sound-minded, good sense, and high ideals. She had superior intelligence. There was a mental depth that most girls lacked. She was completely sincere in trusting and believing in people. She had not seen or learned much of the rottenness and evils of this world. And most important of all, strength of character. She was very much an extrovert, but not a shallow, gossipy chatterbox." He talks here about how they wrote letters to each other. Pretty much Mr. Armstrong is writing to her every day as they grew closer. And he received several responses from her each week. He said, "We exchanged ideas on many subjects. I wanted to know what she was interested in, what she believed, what her ideas were. She seemed to have high ideals, and I discovered that she was seriously concerned about religious truth, more so than I." So all these descriptions here, he's talking about personality and her way of thinking, her mind. Where does he ever say anything about looks? Now, of course, there does have to be attraction there, but you see Mr. Armstrong's priorities. Even when he was in his early 20s, even before marriage, even before God called him, you see the priorities. And as he had said later on in life, that two people who are converted to God's truth can make it work. That doesn't mean we should try to force every relationship, but certainly what matters most is having the same belief system, having the same goals, being able to think and talk together, having personalities that really do entertain each other and keep us alert and ready for interesting new things. Really just such a beautiful description of his wife Loma here in chapter 9, and also there's more in chapter 10. And it's hilarious because Mr. Armstrong says, like, Loma was living in Iowa and Mr. Armstrong was living in Chicago at the time. Mr. Armstrong saying how business seemed to require my presence in Iowa again in early April and then the first week in May. He just keeps finding reasons to go back and visit her again and again. Isn't that amazing how that works? When you have an interest in somebody like that, you do tend to make time for that person. Chapter 10 of the autobiography is titled Marriage Plans Complicated by War. I was interested by this story here of Mr. Armstrong applying a couple different times, several different times, to basically go to war in World War I for America. And yet, every time he sent in the application, it seemed like he was about to get assigned to a camp and prepare for battle. And yet, right at the last moment, every time, a flood of last-minute applications came in, and because there were enough men with prior military experience and also enough men who were taller than Mr. Armstrong didn't end up going to serve in World War I. So they gave priority to those who had already been in battles before and to those who were taller men. And Mr. Armstrong was only of average height, so maybe that was God's way of keeping him out of war. And he got married right around this time, too. But Mr. Armstrong, looking back, writing about his life of experiences, his really world-changing, especially church-changing life, that God was preparing him in a variety of different ways. God's hand was in his life in all of these details over many years, over nearly an entire century of life. I just thought I'd mention here, Mr. Armstrong says, "In those days, I felt very proud of Chicago." I know a lot of people, a lot of my close friends are from there, and they'd be happy to hear that, so I thought I'd just throw it in. He talks about his marriage and how, "I have always felt there is no nicer wedding than a plain, simple ceremony without ostentation of formal dress, with only the minister and two witnesses present. I think it is usually the bride's mothers who engineer the lavish weddings." Or in my case, since my wife's mother was, or still lives in South Africa, pretty far away, my own mother engineered my lavish wedding. She was very much excited about that anyway, and my sister Paris was heavily involved in that. That just shows one of the many differences between men and women. Women obviously dream their whole lives from the time they're little girls, for the most part, about the wedding day. And for men, it's just another natural step in life. It's something that we do and we enjoy it, but we don't necessarily see as much of a need for all of the pomp and pageantry of it. It sure is nice when it comes around, though. Mr. Armstrong says here, "From the time of marriage, we have always been partners in whatever was my work. Mr. Armstrong and his wife were close in every way, and you can definitely understand why God would use them to raise up the greatest work ever done by God's church." So today we've been talking about chapters 8 through 10 of the autobiography of Herbert W. Armstrong, available for free at thetrumpet.com. Please check it out there. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Grant Turgeon. This has been Behind the Work.
You've been listening to Behind the Work. Email your thoughts to comments at kpcg.fm. Listen for a new episode each Monday at 11:30 a.m. Central Time.